In the interest of time, I'm probably going to make a start. Good morning, and welcome to the session titled Stress and Mental Injuries, How to Compensate. My name is Jason, and I'm the chair for this session. I'd like to introduce our two speakers. Andrew McInerney is a principal of Affinity and spends most of his time working in compensation schemes. His focus is on workers' compensation and asbestos. And when he finds the spare time, he gets back into a little bit of CTP. David Gregory is a senior consultant at Affinity. He has experience working with both compensation schemes and specialised insurers over a number of years. He's even made a workers' compensation claim. Paul, we get them on stage. Just a few housekeeping matters. The first is if you can switch your mobile phones to silent or vibrate. And also, there is an app for feedback, so if you can kindly provide some, the Institute and our presenters would much appreciate that. In terms of timing, the expectation is around 25 minutes where they will go through the presentation, and that should leave around 15 minutes for discussion. Please welcome Andrew and David.
I'm going to start quickly with an apology. So our paper is not up on the website yet. It only got finished yesterday. I've got a 12-week-old son who hasn't been very well, so this has all been pulled together a little bit late. But probably a big thank you also to Dave, because I don't think we'd be here today without his involvement in getting this all done. The background to this paper probably goes back about 5 or 6 years when I first saw Dame Carol Black speak on the health benefits of work. Since that time, I've seen Manfred Aylward speak probably 3 or 4 times and had lunch with him. And that concept really resonated with me, that the work is good for you, and also that the other part to that is that long-term worklessness is bad for you. And that's the part that often goes unsaid. And I guess really the trigger for doing this paper was a Safe Work Australia presentation on mental injuries that came out about 6 months ago that had some information in there that I'd never seen presented so publicly before, and they've very generously given us access to that to play around with it a little bit, and that forms the basis of a lot of what we're going to talk about today. Sorry, I'm just trying to find... So, by many accounts, there's big problems with mental injury and compensating mental injury in the workplace. So I think that's a given. I don't think that there's any disagreement on that one. We're aiming to open a discussion about that. We're not really trying to assert an answer in any way at all, and quite openly acknowledge that we're a couple of actuaries. We have spoken to some medical people in what we've done here, but this is a couple of actuaries putting together what we think is a systemic response to a problem. I'm going to speak for probably about 10 to 15 minutes on some of the background. I guess this is going to go a bit like how the paper has. I'm going to start with lots of enthusiasm, and then I'm going to run out of puff about halfway through, and Dave's going to come in and rescue me again. So I'm going to start with a proposition. That historical treatment paradigms, that is, that you need to recover before you return to work, do not work well for mental injuries. And going further than that, it actually creates a world where personal beliefs and perceptions are repeated and reinforced through the way the system is dealing with people. Under the more modern treatment paradigms, work is good for you and that you need to complete your recovery at work, mental injuries have a lot to gain. So that's our proposition, and really that goes through all that we're going to say to you. That underlies what we're going to say to you today. So what are mental injuries? They are psychological conditions resulting from an event that interfere with an individual's normal ability to function. Fine. The events can be sudden and traumatic. So, for example, being held hostage in a bank robbery, or something that's far more low-level, subjective, ongoing, and that could be harassment at work or bullying, that kind of thing. The types of conditions that we're talking about are things such as stress, depression, anxiety, post-traumatic stress disorder, and an adjustment disorder. Are mental injuries the same as mental disorders? No, they're not. We're talking about a whole different scale of problem here, and I guess Paul kind of touched on a lot of this earlier, and I kind of wish I had the benefit of Paul's presentation before I was doing my prep. There's about 3.2 million Australian adults that have a diagnosable mental disorder every year. So that's about one in five. And that astounded me when I saw that. At the moment, the compensation systems deal with about 10,000 mental injuries per annum. Sorry, compensated mental injuries per annum. And I think I've got the scale right there. So we're talking about far less than 1% of what are mental disorders in the community turn up as mental injuries in compensation schemes. We're not going to go into detail with the presentation, but in the paper we talk a little bit about it. There's some really big social questions here about how this links in with all the other schemes, so whether they're things that are more generous, like leave entitlements, superannuation, life insurance, or some of the safety nets that exist, such as unemployment benefits, disability support, and what's coming up with the National Disability Scheme. Are mental injuries different to physical injuries? I think the short answer is clearly yes. We were trying, being actuaries, we tried to find a couple of ways to get something that was a bit quantitative to present that. So if we start, what we've done here is to try and split physical injuries into two different types, so the acute and the degenerative, and then also mental injuries into the ones that are event-based and perception-based. And this segmentation between what we are calling event and a perception is something that we're going to come back to. We'll explain more in a minute. But loosely, the events are things like being exposed to violence, something that's traumatic, whereas the perception are things more like the harassment, the bullying, the work pressure. So how many claims are we talking about in each of those buckets? Well, physical injuries are by far the bulk of what compensation schemes deal with. And then on the right side, the mental injuries are generally less than 5%. Somewhere like Comcare, that balance is probably a bit different. Maybe the TMF similar, that they would have a different balance. But overall, that's the numbers that we've got. How long does it take to get a claim on the books? Physical injuries, they're pretty quick. They're usually based on some objective information, so that something's happened. We can translate what happened to an injury, whereas the mental injuries, far more subjective. So there can be disagreement about what happened. How is that translated through to the injury? And that process can take much longer, so well into the weeks. Probably very related to that is the proportion that get accepted. So well over 90% of acute physical injuries, where there's very clear cause and effect, become claims, whereas once you get down to the mental injuries, about one in three tend to be rejected, so there's no compensation paid. And where we're going is the bottom bit, the claim duration. So 40% to 50% of the physical injuries would get more than a week of lost time, and the median is under a week for those two. So half the people that get a physical injury have well less than a week off work. Once we're into the mental injuries, more than 60%, and for some of these perception-based injuries, more than 80% are getting more than a week off work, and the median across 3 weeks and 9 weeks. So overall, this is where we start digging into the safe work data. Overall, there's a median of about 6 weeks, and that really blew me away when I saw that. We couldn't find anything on dispute rates, but I expect that you would find that there's some strong differences in the proportion that are disputed and how that goes through the system as well between physical and mental injuries. Why are they different? Really because there's so many different factors that influence whether or not a certain event becomes an injury, and there's subjectivity that goes all the way through that. Underlying personality traits, so things like personal resilience, how you cope with stress, personal circumstances, how's life going, are you having marital problems, is it financial issues? The workplace is key. So that just turns up through all this, the relationships people have at work, the sense of control, and that's one that's, I guess, very difficult to pull apart from all this, and existing psychological conditions. Probably alluded to it, but yes, that subjectivity just goes all the way through the claim life cycle, so from acceptance through to treatment and then what constitutes recovery. One thing that I guess had been ticking away through this work is good for you and worklessness is bad for you is the role of the GP. And Iskra actually had some really great research that came out a month or two ago on how GPs certify time off work. Mental health conditions are far more likely to be certified as unfit for work. So on an initial consult, only 6% of mental health conditions are certified as having any ability to return to suitable duties, compared to 28% for the non-mental conditions. Not only that, the certificates that mental health people get tend to have longer durations. I just thought that in a scheme that's built around the GP as the gatekeeper, clearly all these statements that we're hearing about the health benefits for work are not finding their way through the GP community. So that's a fundamental problem, and that's something that we're going to come back to. This graph's based on some ABS information, so it's from a workplace survey they do, and it's about what happens to people after they get a work-related mental injury. So according to the ABS, there's about 30-ish thousand, maybe 35,000 people per year that say they have a workplace-based mental injury. So if you look at what happens to those first two, the blue and the yellowy, about a third turn up in the compensation system somewhere. So that's our 10,000. So two-thirds of these people do not turn up in compensation systems. One thing that really surprised me is that the ABS info says it's about 50%, 48% of the people in this survey say they have more than a week off work. So 48% are having a week off work, but only 20% are getting compensated. That feels like an inconsistency. Or I guess it's not, once you see some of the other reasons about why they're not getting compensated. But what it does suggest is that there's some real claim propensity risk if these people do start turning up in the compensation system. Mental stress claim frequency. So we've got the all claim frequency there on the bar. Long-term downward trend. I guess this is the message that often comes out of the work health and safety. We're putting a lot of effort into it. Claim numbers are reducing, all good. The red line then is the mental stress claim, so it's kind of bounced up and down a bit, and it doesn't have anywhere near that same pattern to it, and particularly not the downward trend. It's hard, but we did try and dig deeper and look at the information by state. Unfortunately, that was the one thing Safe Work weren't allowed to help us with, was the information by state. And there look to be some very strong differences in what's going on in the different schemes. So I guess ComCare, well known, has some problems with stress claims. A couple of the other states also look like they've got big increases. So probably talking 30 to 40% increases over, say, a five-year period in their stress claims. One or two of the bigger ones look like they've actually reduced. So that would, Victoria was one that looks like it's done reasonably well with holding the numbers there. What causes mental stress claims? And here's where we're coming back to our allocation. So this is something that we've done. This is very much judgmental in allocating these causes into either event-based, which are the exposures to violence, trauma or suicide, or perception-based, which are harassments, pressures, bullying, etc. So if we work around the pie chart, work pressure is perception-based, 33%. Harassment, 25%. So we've already got over half of these mental injuries are coming from the perception-based areas. These two areas have grown quite significantly over the, I think it's about 6 or 7 years since the survey was last done. So when it used to be close to sort of 50-50 between the event-based and the perception-based, it's now running at about 60-40. So we are seeing more of the claims come through from that perception side of things rather than the event that's something that's more objective that people can touch. Lost time. So I guess I've already given the game away on this one with my table a couple of slides earlier, but the all claim median lost time is about 0.6 weeks. And for mental stress claims, it's 6 weeks. So 10 times longer off work for your median claim. And to make matters worse, it's getting higher. So that trend is not good. So this is the same information, just shown as a time series rather than just the last data point. I can only imagine that the median lost time for mental stress claims is going to continue going up. So I think that's the conclusion from that one. What this got us to thinking was, well, why the bloody hell is that going on? And that's when we started digging into these perception and event-based types again. And there's a very interesting set of differences that comes through. So the four, what we've called event-based, exposure to violence, exposure to traumatic event, suicide or the other, have very consistent median lost times of about 3 weeks. Then the three that we've called perception-based, the work pressure, the harassment or the harassment or bullying or the other harassment, have about 9 weeks of median lost time. And I guess this is another one of the points where I just was quite astounded that perception-based injuries, over half the people that get compensated are having more than 9 weeks off work. That just didn't seem right to me, that clearly something's wrong in the system that people are having that long off work, particularly when you then compare it back to the event ones where yes, you can see that people have had something that clearly would be generally accepted, that yes, you've been exposed to something here. We've also, the Insurance Council was generous enough to make available a small amount of information, so it's much harder to get publicly available info on the CTP schemes, or we found it hard anyway. So this chart is showing the proportion of CARS decisions where the claimant has a psychiatric component to their claim, as identified on the insurer databases. So going back to about 2009-2010, 20-30% of claims had a psych component. Last 3 years, that's taken off and is now up to 50%. And interestingly, that's being driven by the less severe ones, so the severity one, whiplashes. Not going to go into any more detail, but really just to try and draw out that what appears to be happening in the workers' comp, and it's what we're hearing anecdotally is happening in the CTP schemes, does appear to show up in the numbers as well. So we haven't gone any further with this, but it was just something to try and draw that out. So what isn't working? Well, in short, there's lots of things that don't seem to be working. The breadth of coverage, so that's a question mark. I guess that's a social question. How far should the compensation schemes go with covering workers' comp? Some of the causation, so we haven't gone into any of the discussion of legal precedents, but there's some very interesting cases that we've noted in the paper, one of which is about how an injured worker's perception, even if it's quite an unreasonable perception, can be enough to establish a workers' compensation claim. Return to work is really the lack of return to work is, I guess, what we're getting at is the big problem here. The difficulty in dealing or naming the workplace issues. Sorry, I skipped one there. The delayed use of medical specialists and medical support. So that, I guess, this is that question of the GP being the one who has primary care for a quite extended period and often. Some serious damage is being done before expert or people who are expert in dealing with mental illnesses are engaged to provide some help. And then the last one's common law. We don't think common law is a good thing for dealing with mental injuries. I'm about to hand over to Dave. I guess the one thing that I haven't written down but struck me when I was looking at this on the plane ride on the way up was that a comment Manfred Aylward made a long time ago, I can't remember where I heard it, was that symptoms are ubiquitous and omnipresent. So if you go looking for them, you're going to find them. And I guess picking up, I think, Paul, you made something around this, that we've got a very active community of stakeholders that exist in these schemes, and they know where to go looking for them to find them. They know what the checklist is, that they know how to ask the question. So if you want to find some reason to keep someone in the compensation system, it's very easy to do with mental illness claims. Is that the right thing for those people in the long term? I guess what we're asserting is no. That there is a paradox there, that in trying to do the right thing in the short term, we're actually creating some long-term harm. Now I'm going to flick over to Dave. So we've got a straw man, and I guess this is where we'll be looking for some input, because we're not asserting it's the right answer, but we felt like we needed to do something to start the discussion.
Well, thank you, Andrew. Good morning, everyone. So I will be bringing the presentation home by going through our straw man proposal. It really is a conversation starter, so when we do open the floor later on, we'd like to go through the suitability for purpose, its advantages and disadvantages. In coming up with the straw man, I will actually show you the slide I'm talking to. We've had five core principles we've had in mind when pulling it together. In reading through that list yourselves, what I hope happens in your mind is, they seem to make sense, and there's nothing too contentious there. The first is probably the premise for the whole thing, and hopefully not too big a leap of faith. Andrew was talking about earlier around getting to work. Getting back to work is the best way to treat a mental illness, mental injury claim. The second is probably the most important to get right and potentially the most difficult. Having the claimant themselves take ownership of their journey back to work is important, but given that the person has just suffered a mental illness injury, prolonged bullying, harassment, or they've witnessed a suicide or something like that, they're not in a good state of mind. It's going to be very difficult for them to believe that returning to work could possibly be a good thing for them. In thinking about the people that the claimant will be talking to through their claim journey, including, the case manager, GP, we're of the view that it's the specialist medical carer, the psychiatrist, psychologist, that would be best placed to give the message to the claimant that getting back to work is the best way to go about it. Hopefully they've got the skills, they know that returning to work is the right thing, they've got the skills to build trust quickly, hopefully, and give that message that, looking after your well-being is the best achieved through returning to work. We'd like that process to start as soon as possible, hence the third point there. Andrew was talking about common law and legal involvement, so that's on the list. And the last is really a methodology for greasing the wheel to get return to work happening as efficiently as possible. If going back to your current employer isn't going to be a suitable outcome, start that job search early and try to find an alternative employment. So I'll present the straw man along the lines of a claim life cycle. We'll go through the acceptance process, eligibility, and then the specifics around the actual benefits, weeklies, permanent impairment, and then sort of move through to some ancillary points on dispute resolution. The first big call, I guess, that we've made is to treat the event-based claims separately to the perception-based claims. You'll see the words, the sort of sub-bullet points under the perception-based ones, A and C borrow heavily from eligibility criteria that's currently legislated. Unfortunately, we've introduced another shade of grey on the spectrum with the introduction of the reasonable employee, so that's obviously a danger area. Regarding claim acceptance, we struggled to come up with carrots, if you think about carrots and sticks, to incentivise employers to actively engage in the return to work process. So we've resorted to using fines for late lodgement and things like that. That's gone into a little bit more in the paper. Regarding decision making, I think we're of the view that GPs maintaining their role as the initial gatekeeper regarding provisional liability should be maintained. However, after 4 weeks, that responsibility transitions through to the expert medical specialist. And the second part, we've got some bullet points there on early intervention and what needs to happen. And what I hope comes out through reading that is just how much activity needs to happen in a short space of time after there's been a claim reported. We need a case manager to come in within 2 days, need momentum maintained with mediation within a week, And through that process, you know, if it's identified that going back to your current employer isn't the right way to go, start a job search and get a work search happening as soon as possible. Now, specifically looking at weeklies, again, as for most of the benefit types, we're proposing different structures for the event-based, traumatic event-style injuries versus perception-based. We're of the view that current frameworks are appropriate for the event-based injuries. However, for the perception-based, we are looking to reduce what is currently on offer. With a 4-week cap on weeklies, with an extension to 13 weeks if you've either started a work search or you're back at work for 15 weeks with a high likelihood of returning to full capacity after 13. Now, beyond 13 weeks, there still needs to be income replacement available to the people that really need it, and you know, we're proposing to include that. However, that would be a discretionary power of the scheme with non-reviewable decisions and with a hard 1-year cap after the 13-week period. For medical benefits, we're proposing something similar to what was introduced WorkCover New South Wales in 2012 and putting a 1-year cap on the medicals after the cessation of weeklies. For permanent impairment, we are proposing that they access to those be removed for the perception-based injuries, and for the traumatic event-style injuries, permanent impairment is done on a once-and-for-all basis, or sorry, the assessment is done on a once-and-for-all, and it's only paid for once. And we've got a bullet point at the end that, yeah, we could actually remove those for everything. Maybe we can talk about that in a few minutes. Last slide. Dispute resolution. Clearly, there's dispute resolution processes in place for all the schemes at the moment. The ultimate binding decision in those reviews is made by an arbitrator, a tribunal, or a court. There's avenues in that process to get expert medical advice to opine on medical questions. What we're proposing is a system where the medical expert has a bigger role, and they review more new information. I think with existing frameworks, there's no new evidence really put forward at that last step. We'd like that to change. As Andrew's alluded to earlier, we'd like common law benefits and access to those removed, and similarly, secondary mental injuries would not be compensable. So that's the straw man. That's a lot of information in a short period of time, but we would like to talk about it. So please, we've got a few questions you may like to ask, so fire away.
Just before we run with the questions, there's a mic over there in the middle of the room. As the session's recorded, if you could state your name and question, that'd be great. Otherwise, I can pass this around.
Thanks, David. Sophie from Comcare. I just had a question on your one of the when you went through the life of claim for your straw man.
Yes.
And about initial liability. It seemed that you were suggesting that claim acceptance should be through GPs as the gatekeeper, and I was just wondering what your thoughts are about relying on independent medical exams for that initial gatekeeper rather than just the treater.
Yeah, well, we certainly want that specialist medical care to start as soon as possible and be involved in decisions around returning to work and that kind of thing. I think the process of GPs being involved is so entrenched we can't completely abolish that, and it's quite likely that the work will have a long-standing relationship with the GP, trust them, and are going to go and talk to them. It's then the decisions around, you know, are you going to be, if you're working 15 hours a week now, will you be at full capacity in another 13? That's where the medical expert would be making decisions. So it's fairly early on in a, so it's only within sort of 4 weeks of the start that they'd be really making some important decisions.
But you haven't looked at whether you're relying on an independent exam for the actual initial acceptance of the claim?
Well, the GP would be making a call on provisional liability, and then actual acceptance would be based, what do you think, Andrew, on?
Yeah, I think that's, I guess the question, a couple of things that I would think of in responding. So one's the efficiency question. So are you spending too much money on dealing with the bulk when you just try and strip it down to just the ones that are going to be the problem? Probably more so it's about the timeliness, how quickly you can get that independent medical advice. So the GP normally is available that day or very soon thereafter. So in the kind of balance of getting things right, I'd lean towards get the benefits started on a provisional liability basis only because you've got a 4-week cap. So which means if you get it wrong, you haven't lost so much.
Greg McCarthy from South Australia. We've got a massive problem with psychological injury in South Australia. Picking up on your point about the GP. You know, the reality is GPs are great for cough, colds and flu and paediatrics and geriatrics, and they're not real good at this sort of stuff. The problem with IMEs and I like what you said earlier about getting them into appropriate specialist care quickly, is that I don't know what the experience is in other jurisdictions, but it was certainly my experience in New South Wales when I was there and in South Australia, is it can often take 6 to 8 weeks to get those. So we've actually entered into negotiations in the last 2 weeks with two types of medical opportunities, one being the IME, which is about disability and liability, where we're taking block bookings and with the right doctors for that, where we get them in within 4 to 5 days. And then on the other side of it, we're also putting together block bookings for what I would call, you know, if you woke up in the bed yourself and you wanted to see the right doctor's name above your head, the treatment that we're also taking, but they're not IME. So there's a difference between an IME and a treater. So almost the IME is about the question of are we liable or aren't we? If you are liable, right at the outset, getting them quickly into a specialist treater who can support the GP and the injured worker. But the challenge is to get them in quickly. We did this in New South Wales quite a few years ago with what we call second opinion or peer review for musculoskeletal. So we're trying the same thing, or about to try the same thing in South Australia with psych injuries. But the challenge is that if you really are practising early intervention, that you need to get them in quickly. 6 to 8 weeks is too long. And the only way you can do that with these guys is to guarantee them you've got to block book them, you get the appointment set aside. If you don't use them, you've just got to pay for them. Small cost.
That's essentially what we came up with in the paper, is that you transfer that risk back to the scheme, so the scheme has to provide that guarantee, but then it's the scheme's job to use that resource.
But you've got to get a differential between where the question is around are we liable versus are we looking for support for the GP in how to treat their patient, and they're two different appointments. And in fact, the treatment one's almost an offer to an injured worker, whereas an IME is you will go. But it is about getting them in very quickly. The other issue is around the provisional liability issue. I think provisional liability, and I'm going to show some information tomorrow afternoon in the session that I'm doing, that actually I think will demonstrate provisional liability exacerbates stress claims, doesn't actually help them. And I think one of the problems that I can see again from South Australia is that one of the things that we didn't or haven't or we've lost the ability to say is one word in South Australia, is that when you need to say it, you need to know when to say no. And the reality is that if you come back to, I think it is, the reasonable management actions, most of the jurisdictions, and certainly South Australia is no exception, is pretty clear. If it's as a result of reasonable management actions, you haven't got a claim. So why would you put them on personal liability? Because all you're doing is creating a false expectation that people are going to get paid, and they get 13 weeks, and by the time you get to the end of it, it's almost too hard to say no. And if you've got tribunals, which most of them are around Australia, that are basically, it isn't a question of whether you win or lose, just a question of how much you lose by. You know, you're really wasting your time. So you've got to tackle those hard issues right at the outset. And if the answer, you know, you've got to be firm but fair. If the answer's no, say no. And we've actually redesigned our claims operating guidelines in South Australia only in the last 2 weeks, that when we need to say no, we say no. Now, one of the things that was put to me was, the claims officers won't be able to do that for the case managers. Well, I'm not sure if there's anyone from AML or GBs in the room today, but the reality is if your claims officers aren't up to it, then they're not the right people. You need to recruit the people that are capable of making hard decisions. And I think that there's a lot of, you know, we haven't been firm but fair. I think we've been too easy to let people have. Yeah. So I think there's a lot of merit in what's been put up here.
Just
today. I actually quite like it. I'm going to steal it. No, we're already paying him.
Andrew's our actuary.
So that would be my only... that's why I thought it might be just useful to go through the slides and just comment them. I think provisional liability is a danger. I'm going to show a slide tomorrow that actually shows that since the introduction of provisional liability in South Australia, our claims have gone up by, about 10 more lots. And not only have they gone up by lots, but they're three times the average cost.
Thanks, Greg. I think we may have time for one more question.
Hi, I wondered, and two questions are sort of related, whether you did any analysis or were able to do any analysis by occupation. And it relates to my concern about one of the things, which is you've got a different sort of scheme or benefits for the perception versus the traumatic event ones. And I think if you're talking about some occupations where, like emergency services, police, those sorts of occupations where actually they're watching or seeing traumatic events all the time, what you could end up with just reallocation, if you like, of the cause of the injury from perception to event-based. So, and just getting that definition right might be a real practical issue in terms of what you put forward.
Can't disagree with any of that. Didn't have the time to dig very deeply into the occupation-based information, so more took that as a given without looking at segments below it. There are much higher frequencies into those sort of emergency services and kind of people with responsibility for others. As I said, things like carers, teachers as well. Also, I guess, didn't go into the distinction between public and private sector, but I imagine that's another area where you would find some strong differences.
Maybe one more.
Hi, I'm Catherine Gobby. I'm Employees Mutual. I guess I was just interested in the impairment comment that we've had a great case study in South Australia where impairment isn't payable for mental injuries, and whether, but obviously highly payable in New South Wales with the emergency services particularly, but whether that's helped, you know, in looking at ultimate health outcomes, we haven't had that as a, I guess, adverse incentive in SA, but the problem still exists, I suppose.
I think the weaklies is a far bigger problem than the employment.
Yeah.
Thank you, Andrew and David, for the straw man and the library discussion afterwards. Would you all join with me in thanking them for the presentation?